Close the door here.
Yeah, we can leave it ajar. So for the latecomers. Yep. So I'm happy to introduce Alex Loftus.
Sure.
My PhD student, and he's going to give a perspective on interpretability by using some analogies to biological discovery.
Yeah. I decided to give this talk on biology to an interpretability lab, which is a pretty weird thing to do. Why am I talking about biology to a bunch of interpretability people? There's been kind of this conversation in the zeitgeist recently of interpretability. And the argument kind of goes like, interpretability is really similar to biology in this sense that biological systems are these natural things that grow kind of on their own, and deep learning systems are also these things that sort of grow on their own, right? You set up the architecture, and then you set up the training data, and then you just like let backpropagation do its thing. And this has been, talked about a whole bunch. David has brought up that interpretability, that the role of interpretability is sort of analogous to the role of biochemistry. So, if we can get closer to this sort of mechanistic understanding of how these large language models work and how these huge systems work, then we unlock all these doors that were unlocked analogously with biochemistry. A bunch of people have been, kind of saying the same thing. Chris Ola loves saying this. Dario Amodei in his Machines of Love and Grace essay said this. And so I figured that I kind of agree with this. I have a biology background from undergrad, and I worked in a wet lab, and I worked in a drug discovery company for almost 2 years doing machine learning for drug discovery. And there actually are a lot of analogies that I've noticed. And I do think that we as interpretability researchers can gain a lot from understanding a little bit about what the biologists have done in the last 150, 200 years. So there's kind of two main things that I want us to get out of sort of a discussion about biology. The first is inspiration, right? So what does it look like for interpretability as a field to be successful in the next, 5, 10 years, right? 15 years, whatever, right? And then the next is direction. So if we have this sort of understanding a little bit of what the biologists did, we can sort of envision what the equivalent of that might look like in interpretability. And so the way that I want to do this is to zoom in to a really simple research question that the biologists have had over the last 40 years and that they've managed to solve quite successfully. That has led to a lot of downstream drug applications and a lot of sort of interesting use cases. And we understand the entire mechanism, and it's provided a lot of value to people. And so that mechanism is when the human brain, when two neurons in the human brain fire concurrently, the connection between those two neurons is strengthened. And so how does that work? And at what level of detail do we understand how that works? This is a question that this phenomenon was first noticed in the 1950s, possibly even earlier, right? And biologists were really curious about this for a long time. It's sort of core to the entire field of memory and learning. And in biology, this mechanism is called long-term potentiation. And the whole every part of the of how this works mechanistically is pretty well understood at this point. So I'm just going to give like a brief overview, and then we'll zoom into one of the kind of central character, the central protein that's involved in allowing this to happen, and then we'll look a little bit at how the process of understanding this mechanism occurred. So this is a synapse. So these are two neurons. So if you zoom in two, you can think of like two trees next to each other, and the trees, and they're each tree is a neuron, and the trees have these branches that are all intertangled with each other. And if you zoom in to one of the branches, you can see a synapse, and the synapse are sort of the points of connection between the two neurons. The way that they interact with each other is that the presynaptic neuron, the first neuron, is sending a signal to the second neuron. That's the presynaptic membrane. And so the way it works is when the first neuron fires, it sends these chemicals over the synapse. That's these orange things. And those chemicals land in these receptors in the second neuron. Once the chemicals land in these receptors, these are called AMPA receptors, they're kind of like floodgates that open. So these chemicals kind of like dock into these receptors, and that opens these doors. And that allows chemical charge to kind of flow through this membrane from this sort of like space outside the membrane into it. And then that chemical movement causes all kinds of downstream effects to happen. But one of those effects is that this second neuron is now more likely to fire. And so the whole process of signal propagation in the brain occurs through sort of like network effects of this, right? One neuron sends these chemicals that causes electrical changes in the second neuron that causes the second neuron to be more likely to fire, and then it sends signals to its downstream neurons and so on. And so that's how you have like this signal propagation in the
I have a
human
very
brain.
stupid question about your diagram. So, can you point to how which is the first neuron, which is the second neuron, and where it's not in the neuron?
So this is the first neuron. It's the presynaptic membrane. This is the second neuron. It's the postsynaptic membrane. This is super zoomed in to just one of the synapses.
And then what's not in the neuron?
Not in the neuron is all of this space surrounding it.
And then,
So,
how come you have like a double line for the second neuron there?
this double line?
Yes.
Oh, this is the membrane. So this is this
Sure.
yeah, this, it's kind of like the skin of the second neuron. So it's this tissue that surrounds the second neuron. And like blocks all of the electrical charge in this like sort of background
I see. And
space
you just didn't
to come
bother
in.
drawing a double line around the other neuron.
Yeah, I didn't bother it because this is a bit of a wacky zooming situation. So the presynaptic membrane is actually like way bigger than that. But I didn't. It's not drawn to scale. Just so that we could show that this is sort of like a membrane that like kind of is poking out a little bit. Just to like get some idea of the shape of it. Yeah.
Is this a, I'm sorry, is this a continuous or a discrete signal? Like, is it like, it like,
Oh, it's discrete.
it's a
So
discrete signal.
that's like an interesting thing about neurons is when they send a signal, it's like a short burst. And it's like it's in like a about 2 milliseconds is how long the signal lasts, and then it ends. So like you can imagine like if this is sending a lot of signals, right? It's like boop, 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 boop. It's like much more likely to cause this second neuron to fire because you send a signal, it like sends some charge in, but that's not enough, and the charge starts like depleting, and then it sends another signal, and the charge gets higher and higher and higher until eventually like this second neuron like fires. But it's like a discrete process.
Is this statement, neurons that fire together wire together, indicative of how circuits are created by one neuron firing and then downstream another one firing and then?
So that statement is exactly what like the mechanism by which that happens is what we're exploring right now. So the wire together is actually exactly what I'm about to show happening. So like what is happening when it's wired together. So I'll give you like a sneak preview. What it actually means for them to wire together more is more of these receptors are going to appear on this membrane. Because remember, like these chemicals bind, like attached to these things. These are the floodgates. When these things are attached, the floodgates open. So if there's more floodgates, then like more water can get through. The water being the electrochemical charge. And so you can imagine like a giant like ocean, and there's like one little like pipeline for water, and so like only a little bit of water gets in. But if there's like a whole bunch of pipelines for water, then like a lot more can get in. And so those the two areas are much more tightly bound together, if that makes sense.
I'll say I'm still confused where the, because you mentioned when introducing this figure that two neurons firing at the same time, And I only see two neurons here. One fires, the other one sort of receives.
So that's a little bit of a subtle point. When this neuron fires a lot at this second neuron is more likely to fire as well, because this second neuron causes there to be more charge in this. The first neuron causes there to be more charge in the second neuron. And so so the second neuron is like more likely to have enough charge to send its own signal. There's a causal, like it's causal. The first neuron causes the second one to charge. The second one doesn't cause the first one to charge. Another aspect is like somewhere else in the second neuron, there might be like a signal back to the first one, right? And then that might cause the first one to get more input from the second one, right? So, but yeah, we're like a little bit in the, anyway. But so that's the process, right? Central to this process, does anyone else have any other questions? Okay. There's two types of things that can happen when one neuron sends a signal to another one, right? The first type of thing is these floodgates open. And the second type of thing is these little guys can cause like chemical effects. These are called NMDA receptors. And so the process by which this wiring happens is a lot to do with these second guys. There's this protein that we're going to look at. This is like a little bit more complicated version of the first diagram. When this protein is attached to, these are the floodgates, these AMPA receptors. When this protein is attached to these NMDA receptors, it basically grabs AMPA receptors and like attaches them to the membrane. So this is a protein that like it attaches to, it attaches to these NMDA receptors. It grabs AMPA receptors and it like places them on the membrane to like cause more firing. And that's pretty much the mechanism by which this like wiring happens, right? You have a signal that gets sent from the first neuron to the second neuron. The second neuron receives that signal when the second neuron has this change in its charge state. This protein gets activated. The protein attaches to this receptor, and then it starts grabbing new floodgates to like put onto the membrane, right? And so and then the more signals get sent, the more floodgates there are, and that's sort of the mechanism by which this this wiring happens. And so this protein, it's called CAMK2, has two kind of roles. So it strengthens synapses by adding these floodgates. And it's also sort of a memory mechanism. So you have this firing that happens in millisecond timescales, and then this protein kind of stays there, and it keeps adding more floodgates over the course of like minutes to hours. And so you have this like long-term effect of like more and more wiring happens, not just because of like not just within the time span of like a single signal, but over the course of like a bit longer. It's this there's this mechanism by which this memory stuff happens. It basically gets I guess I won't go this deeply into the details by which that happens, but there's basically this this other protein that attaches to it. It opens up once the other protein is attached, and it just kind of stays open for quite a while. And when it's open, it like binds and like puts the floodgates in. So like the biologists understand this like pretty deeply, right? We can track these, we can watch these proteins move around, we can see them attached to these other proteins, we can understand this whole mechanism, right? And we can watch as more of these receptors get put on the membrane, and then we can watch learning more learning, like more signal propagate through these neurons. And so how did we figure out, how did the biologists figure out how that works? You know, what was the process by which they understood this mechanism? So it's a lot of decades of research. This protein was first discovered in the early 80s. And, you know, it was really like 2009 by the time this was sort of fully figured out how this worked. So, you know, I think people in deep learning like to think on these sort of short timescales, right? Like, you know, everything has to be figured out in the next like couple years. But, you know, it took them like 30 years to like get at this sort of simple mechanism. So, you know, the protein that causes this to happen was first found in, you know, the early 80s. And there's two sort of methods by which it was isolated. So the first is you can take the protein and you can put it in this little tube and spin it around. And you can take like a brain soup and put it in this tube and spin it around. And that sort of separates all of the proteins in this brain soup by size. And so then you can grab all of the proteins that are of an equivalent size and put them in this column. And that separates them by electrical charge. And so you can isolate like individual proteins by sort of like running through this process. And so, you know, when scientists first started doing this, it sort of started as this process of like exploration. It was like, let's just take some mice. Let's like grab their brains. Let's grind the brains up, turn them into soup, and then let's like find all the proteins that are in that soup. And we're not actually looking for like any particular protein. We're just like kind of looking around at like all the proteins, and we're like, and now they're all separated because we have these two methods to separate them. And like, what looks interesting out of all the proteins in this brain soup? And so this one looked kind of interesting because it was just like, there was a lot of it there, right? It was 4% of all the proteins in the brain soup. And they were like, maybe we should just like look at that because it makes up like a good proportion of the soup, right? And then there were these methods in the late 80s that where you can, they figured out how to genetically modify mice. And so they were like, okay, we like, this protein looks interesting. What happens if we like make some mice that like can't have this protein? Like, do they just die? Or like, what happens to them, right? So this is like these really basic questions and no one had any idea what it did yet, right? This is like 1986, 1987, kind of like that, right? So the mice, it turns out, with this protein that's 4% of their brain soup, like could give birth, the mice could grow, right? There's all these normal mouse things that could still happen, but the mice can't actually learn anything. They don't learn skills. They don't learn to avoid harmful stimulus. They literally can't learn at all. And so all of the people who were interested in learning and memory were like, holy shit, you know, there's this counterfactual where mice can't learn anything if they don't have this protein. So this protein must be involved in how learning works. And so everyone kind of like all like started doing research on this protein because of this sort of like really interesting thing that was like, this kind of smells interesting because of this whole mouse thing. And so they started getting deeper into the mechanism of how this protein does its whole memory thing. I won't really, you know, get into the details of this, but, you know, one thing that they could do to like study this mechanism was, they could put radioactive signals onto these molecules, and they could watch the molecules like move around. So, and then they could discover stuff through just tracking these radioactive molecules, right? So, say we want to know if one of these molecules binds to this protein, we can put the protein in a jar with these molecules, and then we can separate them again, and then we can see if any radioactivity is in the jar with only the protein. Because if it is, then they've like clamped together, right? So there's all of these techniques that were getting developed over the course of the 20th century that all were sort of different views on like different ways of understanding the same mechanism and sort of different microscopes that that they could use to figure stuff out. And so really careful experimental design was another part of this, right? They repeated this test for the separation under a bunch of different conditions to isolate exactly which proteins needed to be together for this binding to happen. And it was just a lot of like sort of very careful ongoing research that sort of looked like this that eventually led to figuring out how this mechanism worked. And so by 2009, methods in biology had sort of progressed to the point where you could actually see this stuff happen. So that I think that was really cool for a lot of biologists because they had sort of been flying blind for the last 30 years. And then in 2009, there were these techniques that started appearing where you can make proteins glow, and microscopes had gotten a lot more powerful. And so they could actually like watch in real time as these floodgates sort of got attached to this membrane. And so in 1999 is when they figured out that this protein binds to these receptors on the membrane and that it stays there and like grabs the floodgates. In 2000 was when they discovered that like not only does it stay there, but it like adds the floodgates. And then in 2009, we could sort of watch this happening in real time. And so like a lot of the sort of experimental hypotheses were like sort of confirmed by just seeing it in action. And so how did biologists like figure this out? So so it started with this observation, which is that if you turn mouse brains into soup, there's a lot of this protein, so it might be interesting. And then there is this hint of a research smell. So so if mice don't have this protein, the mice can't learn anything. And so then you have this general sense that like maybe this protein is involved in learning and memory. And then there is just this like ton of researchers piling on to this mechanism and a lot of buildup of different methods and different microscopes to look at the same thing from different angles. You have these tools to isolate the objects of study. So you can take the proteins out of the brain soup and look at them in separate test tubes. And so you can sort of like see them on their own instead of like being meshed up with everything else. you have all these tools now to discover mechanisms. So you can, put these radioactive particles onto molecules, and then you can track where that radioactivity is so you can sort of see where they're going. And then with careful experimental design, you can understand mechanisms through doing that. And then we have these tools to get at causality. So so we knew that this protein caused learning and memory to disappear because we had this counterfactual of being able to create mice without the protein. And so they were able to get a causality rather than just correlation through these methods that that caused this sort of forcing function to happen. And then we had these tools to zoom in more. So we could get exact protein structures by the early mid 2000s, right? That's like why AlphaFold exists, for instance. We can watch proteins do stuff in real time through more zooming in. And so it was sort of this massive methods build up, research smell, and careful experimental design over a very long time period that let the biologists get to this point. What equivalents are there in interpretability to this? So for what we're doing, one of the things that we're doing in the lab is Josh and I are doing this attendome projects, and that's sort of like isolating the objects of study. If you want to understand what an attention head does, and you want to understand the classes of attention heads, you need to be able to isolate the properties of those attention heads. And so if you can take a bunch of different models and put them all into the same embedding space, then you know, then maybe you can start to get it at general questions of function. And then how do you discover mechanisms? Well, the lab is getting really good at causal questions, right? You know, we have causal mediation analysis. We can get at counterfactuals really easily. And then how do we zoom in? Well, Stephen is doing if you understand what influence functions are doing, then you can sort of you get extra you can benchmark a class of functions. So anyway, so big picture takeaways for interpretability. We're at like a really big advantage compared to the biologists. So we have this iteration time advantage. So the biologists have all these problems in wet lab. So they it takes them weeks to do anything because they have to wait for cells to grow. There's all these problems with noise, right? Cells often bind to other cells, and there's these, you know, viruses get in really easily, and it's kind of annoying to set up the test tubes. We don't have any of those problems. We also have tools that let us see the systems in a lot more detail. We don't have any noise in our measurement tools compared to the biologists, or at least a lot less noise. And the progress for the biologists happened from stacking complementary views on the same question. So so they use these radio labels to track radioactivity. They have these counterfactuals that they got with these knockout mice. They use these fluorescent dyes to be able to see what's happening in real time. And they have these assays that separate out you know, the different objects of study. And so our equivalents right now are we have causal tracing to sort of tease apart causality. We have probing methods, we have circuit tracing, you know, and we have representation learning, you know, so we have this sort of like equivalent and much more rapid buildup of tools. Yeah, that's pretty much my talk.
Cool. I love the radio labels, you know, example. You know, what do you think is an analogy to, you know, sticking a radioactive, you know, atom in a molecule?
Yeah.
Tracking it around.
I don't know. I guess that would be like, it's sort of like tracking information flow. So it'd be kind of like the causal graphs where you're you know, like, you know, that Anthropic blog post where they're sort of tracking, features, as they like move through that causal graph. That seems like the closest analogy that we have to that.
Chris had an answer. What did you say? I didn't see your comment. I just saw your name fly by.
I only have more questions.
You have what?
I also want radio labels. And
yeah.
I think like one challenge that we have and that the biologists maybe have less is that we don't have like this base layer of reality, or like we don't have atoms. We don't have, you know, proteins or something like.
Yeah, right. It's hard to know what the objects are for us compared to the biologists, where it was like kind of obvious. That's true. Yeah,
because it all mixes together like numerically, right? Like,
yeah. I think that's like a base challenge that we have is like this separation problem of like, you know, with the biologists, it's like you put them in columns and then you have these like really obvious things that you can look at, and for us, it's like, you know, it like. Is it subspaces? Is it attention heads? You know, is it individual neurons? Is it like SAE, you know, outputs, right? Like, yeah, it's that's something that we have to figure out.
I mean, it does seem like with the residual stream stuff, that everything kind of turns into a large summation. So you do have you can take pieces of the sum and just like take them individually and see what happens to them.
Yeah.
But yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but to like put a radio label on like a feature and then track it as it moves through the model would be like, that I think would be the...
that would be the equivalent. Yeah, yeah. And I guess we don't have any like exact analogy to that. Yeah. Cause like the, you know, cause and like it, could you even, it, like, does that even make sense to talk about? Like at the beginning of a residual stream, is it like the same feature that gets like changed over the course of the stream, or like, does it make sense to talk about it like that? Yeah, I'm not sure.
I don't know. I feel like the radio is thing solving something much more basic that is very trivial in CS. Something like, you know, what's the activation here and what's multiplied by this weight, and that's how much information going to the next neuron.
So, like, yeah,
that's a huge deal for neuroscientists to figure out, like, how much information passed from this neuron to the other neuron. But that's like a given for for CS.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, okay. So there's like, seems to be quite a big difference between a digital neuron and like a real neuron.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there's anything to be gained from modeling the actual real neuron as compared to just the artificial neural network that we have?
I don't know. I feel like that's how we started in deep learning. Like, you know, I mean, a lot of the research money that was put into deep learning in like the, you know, 70s and 80s was like these psychologists that claimed that they were like modeling actual neurons. We in intro neuroscience classes, you actually learn about like some of that work, which is kind of an interesting like parallel. And then, you know, it kind of drops off really fast. But I'm not super confident that, I mean, maybe, I don't know. It like they tried to do that a whole bunch in the 80s. And it led to a lot of stuff. Like it sort of evolved into what we have now. But I'm not sure that it like, you know, it sort of like naturally veered away, I guess, throughout the research process. I don't know, but you know, maybe there's something to be gained. Yeah.
An artificial neural network as a mechanistic model of the brain, then you have to think about which level of abstraction you're thinking about it. You could think about it as it's implementing a similar function as the brain, or you can think about it as, well, it's learning similar representation, or you can go even deeper, like, well, it's actually implementing similar mechanism of single neuron, etc. I guess for different neuroscientists evaluate differently.
Yeah. There's also this question of like, yeah, like what Josh said, you can zoom in like almost as much as you want, right? Because like once you like the level of abstraction that I was talking about was at proteins, but like you can also zoom in to like parts of proteins and you can look at individual atomic interactions if you want. And we understand that too. And then you can zoom into these individual atomic interactions. And you can look at like the quantum effects of those. Like you can like, you know, and you obviously can't simulate at that level. So yeah, it is sort of a interesting question. Yeah.
One sort of thing that was lingering on my mind during the talk was how, I guess, I think it's in part because I don't have as big of a biology background. So a lot of the metaphors aren't necessarily as immediate.
Yeah.
But I was thinking how, it just sort of applies for all of science, anything that uses the scientific method as a way of figuring out things.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stuff seems analogous. Like, for example, like tooling, I guess biology is a very good metaphor with like, you know, zooming in, but like, I mean, you can think of like, I don't know, the like for experimental physics, like they build better machines, like let you get more precise and then you can get more confirmation for your hypothesis.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm curious is, and I mean, the radio labels discussion, I think helped me see a bit more the direct, maybe sort of philosophical similarities that mm-hmm. you can kind of use. But what, I guess, like, do you think, because at the start you sort of motivated us understanding more biology to have a better sense of like how to go about things, how I guess would you, or like what things would be worth analyzing in more detail to gain good insights?
Oh, like in interpretability, or like what do you
Or
mean?
interpretability.
What would be worth analyzing in more detail? I don't know. I mean, I don't know. That's a big question. I think the one of the big challenges that we have in front of us is figuring that out. Like what we were saying before, I think for us it's not as obvious like what to zoom in on as it is for the biologists, because they have these like discrete, really like obvious things to look at. And for us it's like sort of more of a soup of matrix multiplications, right? Yeah, so I think that's hard to know.
Is then the case or the point you're making that there's a lot of existing things that have been completed and there's lessons to be learned from the history of how they developed?
I think the motivational point that I'm trying to make is you have these two systems that are both grown, and the biologists have actually figured out a ton and this very particular mechanisms that exist in this biological grown system. And it took them for a long time to do it, but they've made a ton of progress. And they have worse tools than we have, and they have more noise than we have. And all they had was like time and like ongoing effort. So that's the motivational point that I'm trying to make.
I see, I
And then
see.
the
Motivation,
yeah, and then the directional point that I'm trying to make is a lot of this progress happened through a combination of like increasingly good tooling and then sort of looking at the same questions with like a lot of different tools, and understanding the parts of them with all these different like methods of looking at the objects of study.
I see.
It has a question online.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I was just asking if there was like this resistance to ingenuity when it comes to the biology aspects, because now I see
Sorry, what?
lots of the, for example, Dan Hendricks. Is it audible?
Yeah, sorry, you were cutting out a little bit at the beginning, but I think we can hear you now.
Yeah, so I was just asking if there's any parallels between the current resistance and interpretability. Was there some sort of resistance before as well?
Oh yeah, so I think then you would be going back to the 1800s is sort of when this like interpretability quest in biologists really got started, like kind of the end of the 1800s. I think there was, I mean, before that, everyone in medicine was doing everything, really empirically and really like kind of almost like alchemy, right? Where it was like, it looks like maybe if we have these long bird masks on, then we like won't get the flu as much. So let's everyone wear these bird masks, right? That was like those Black Death pictures that you see of the plague doctors, right? Because they thought that like there was something in the air, right? So it's like, and I think they didn't bother to look at mechanisms for quite a while, until there was like some results that started to appear that made people realize that looking at mechanisms was useful. Yeah. So I think there's, but there's a little bit of a difference, which is that I think biology, like there wasn't this same sort of like big separate culture of like economically motivated, kind of just build attitude. Like I think for us, we have a whole culture of people in industry that like are getting a lot of economic value right now out of sort of ignoring mechanism and just continuing to build out big systems. And I don't think there was the equivalent of that in biology in the 1800s. Yeah.
Actually, a good example of that, I learned this when I was pre-med, was like the first time that someone like medically recommended hand washing as a procedure for doctors. There's this guy named Ignaz Semmelweis, and he worked at a hospital where they did a lot of deliveries, and then also the surgeons or the people that would do that they would get done with working with dead bodies. So they'd go from the dead bodies to delivering babies, and then the moms would get sepsis. And he was like, we need to start washing our hands because there's all these moms that are getting sepsis, but because they're like these really proud surgeons that like they were super confident that they knew what was going on, but they weren't really looking into mechanisms. And there was like that economic factor too of like, you know, this is a waste of my time. Mm-hmm. They didn't wash their hands for so long. But I think by knowing the mechanisms, you know, that we know now today in biology, there's so much like better practices, which might be like kind of an analogy for like what interpretability could give deep learning, you know?
So my understanding of the early, so, you know, I think there was an interesting, so if you go back and look at the history, there was a split between, in biology, there was a split between botany and medicine. You know, the biologists, you know, were sort of in the tradition of Darwin. They, you know, were very scientific in their way, but the field was all dominated by breeding. And all these breeders, they were like botanists. They would look at physical, observable things in plants and notice if you breed, if you bred the plants in different ways, then different physical attributes would show up differently. And they didn't really think that looking at the chemistry of these things was a productive way of thinking about biology.
Mm-hmm.
There were biologists who looked at chemistry, but they didn't call themselves biologists. They called themselves, you know, physicians. They looked at medicine. And, you know, the idea that you could invent some potion that you drink that cures your disease or something is like an old dream. People have been working on that forever. So a lot of chemistry is related to the medicine people were very interested in the interaction between the body and chemistry. But I think that crossing this divide, like the chemistry people like didn't look at questions of heredity. Like that was that's like the botany people, right? You know, the biologists, the botanists, they think about heredity. The medicine people just think about, you know, what if aspirin is gonna make you feel better or something like that, and what the chemistry of that might be. And so this idea that you might cross between the people who are doing heredity and the people doing chemistry was this cultural divide in the field. It was like two separate fields. And I think that's where a lot of the early resistance of like biological interpretability came from. Like the biochemistry, which is like not, it's like the backbone of the field today. It couldn't really emerge as long as these two fields were separate. And it took a while for people to realize that it was a legitimate thing to do, to either look at heredity when you're looking at, you know, chemistry at the same time, or look at chemistry while you're looking.
Yeah, that's a good example. Yeah.
So I think this is exactly what we're facing today, actually, because the trainers are the breeders, right? And I don't think that they think it's illegitimate to look at, you know, representations and matrix multiplications and things. They just don't think it's relevant to breeding, right? And you know, so I think that's the bridge.
Sweet. Any other questions? Cool. All right. Well, yeah. Thanks,
Thank you, Alex.
Yeah.